Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. It's 4:30 p.m. Eastern on July the 1st, 2020. And I know I marked this show as a title that says Egypt's Egyptian Connections Part 2. But just before the show, I had an urge to open up The Way to Live book, The Art of Living, and to read a little bit about duty to yourself. And I think when Billy talks about duty to self, I wonder if this isn't a creational natural law as well. But let me continue here. It says, unfortunately, the human being generally pays too little attention or no attention at all to his or her duties to himself and to his or her own duties. Many human beings ask, in total unknowledge, what one's duty to oneself and one's own duty actually are. This question is to be answered thus. It deals with those duties which every human being has in regard to himself or herself. For example, that she practices and uses honesty, or that he or she nurtures true benevolence, modesty, and humanity in himself and herself and towards all life, and so forth. In fact, the duties to oneself apply to the human being as the first and most important. Even when many do not recognize this, or do not even intuit it, unfortunately, many human beings simply live for the day without ever having thoughts about their duties to themselves. Thus, it becomes about that very many human beings, object to the human being next to them, and to his or her neglect of his duty, without considering that they themselves, as objectors, do not act any better or exercise and carry out just as much neglect of duty. However, they do need to pay heed to that because they do not understand the fulfillment of their duty to themselves and their own duty, let alone having an intuition about it. One of the creational natural laws that I've been trying to apply more and seem to be learning a little bit more about is the system in order, you know, where you have a life where you do things at the same time and have an exacting schedule, and really, as much as you can, you make every day like the one before it. And I noticed that when you do that and you're using your other creational natural laws like love and striving and the law of harmony, neutral positive thinking, that these all of these things start to snowball and work together, which is extremely interesting the way it works. So I imagine that following system and order is one of your duties to yourself. So therefore, perhaps these duties to ourselves are in fact creational natural laws as well. With fulfillment of one's duty to oneself and one's own duty, nothing is addressed other than one's dealing with oneself. But exactly this dealing with oneself is of the most important significance in the human life, because this also determines how the human being behaves towards his or her fellow human beings and towards the whole environment, and what value of esteem and honor and dignity, and what respect he or she knows the next human in all life. If a human being therefore wants to live truly and fairly, then he or she has to consider and understand that the fulfillment of the duties to him or herself is constantly and always the most important and foremost. Wow. So there's something I could like memorize and consider, and I don't absorb all of the information the first time through, if for certain, as well as the right and fair dealing with oneself, quite certainly being neither useless or uninteresting. I think when you're following system and order, I think it really helps to fulfill these duties to yourself as well. Like, if you're not doing one, it's hard to be doing the other. As well as the right and fair dealing with oneself, quite certainly being neither useless nor uninteresting. It also guarantees that the dealing with the fellow human beings and all other co-life of all kinds is also rightly handled. In fact, the human being should always be big enough to be able to control him or herself, as well as his or her deeds and speaking and so forth, such that he or she always remains master of his or her deeds, speaking, and feelings. This means that he or she must also be his or her master when forced to become loud, and when he or she must raise his or her voice in order to be creating order and so forth. That's interesting that sometimes you do have to raise your voice to create order. Otherwise, chaos reigns supreme. Also, this is a part of the fulfillment of one's own duty and duty to self. It is never excusable for a human being to neglect his or her own duties and duties to self. No matter in which kind and wise that happens. And the dealing with other human beings is not acceptable when he or she only drifts around in order to shine and thereby neglects his or her companionship, even only one iota. Wanting to shine in such a form and posturing with the fellow human being represents truly nothing other than a flight from one's self, because one's own ego cannot be made sufficiently cultivated in order to be able to fulfill one's duty to oneself and one's own duty. For this reason, such a human being always rather concerns him or herself about the needs of the others instead of about the appropriate and required formation of his or her own character, duty to him or herself, and her own duty, and her fulfillment, and their fulfillment. Okay, that such a good book, such an important book, and it works so well with the ideas of system and order and the things we learn from the Might of Thoughts. Well, let me jump over to, I know I've been taking a little excursion into Eric Von Däniken, and we've been talking about Egypt, and we talked about the Giza intelligences yesterday and who they were and what they did and how they influenced the people of the earth with religions. And I didn't talk about Askett's and Billy's trip into the great headquarters of the Giza intelligences, but we've done that before. We'll do it again. I'm going to pick up with just bits and pieces of this that I thought were interesting. There are many interesting things in this book. Eric talks about a friend of his that was murdered. And when he was in Egypt, there was some negative activities there. So I guess you'd call them terrorists that were around. And he also talked about how the ancient aliens show manages to be popular, even in to a degree in the Arab countries, I guess, even though talking about ancient gods is a sacrilege to Muslim, to Islam. There's something called the pyramid texts, in which Osiris is equated with the constellation Orion. It's very interesting that the three pyramids, they seem to line up with the three stars of Orion. And I believe Billy did say that the extraterrestrials that were on the Earth in those days were from Orion. And they did play a role in building these great pyramids. Let me go ahead and read some from the book here. It says, such texts were also found in the crypts of Pepi, Seti, and other pharaohs. The experts sort and arrange these texts into so-called utterances, numbered sayings. On this particular visit, I asked Dr. Galey about these. What do you make of these? The pharaohs believed in another life after death, in a new world. The pyramid text expresses the wishes and ideas. And if not, I ask, what do you mean, I ventured. Maybe it was not about imaginations of another world, but rather about giving thanks for this world. I don't follow you anymore. Let me make my point clear. In the pyramid texts of Yunus, Osiris is equated with the constellation Orion. He drives to the heavenly road. Osiris is a horizon dweller who, with his ship, pushes off from Earth and ascends to heaven. Now, it's interesting. They're gods flying ships and go to heaven in a ship. Now, ships on Earth in those days only were on the sea, at least if they were built by the native Earth population. In addition, Utterance 267 states, a staircase to heaven has been set up for me, and I rose high on the smoke of the great vessel and thundered across the sky in your bark. I don't know what that word is. I may lift off from the land in your, it says it again, B-A-R-Q-U-E. The utterance 584 states, the doors of, and then it says unreadable. Maybe this part of the text was unreadable. The doors of, maybe the ship, that are in the firmament were open to me. The metal doors that are in the starry sky. What does that say? Confronted with such statements, unless you had metal doors on a ship and you were flying in space, then there would be metal doors in the starry sky. Confronted with such statements, someone like me had to think of something other than psychologically interpreted wishes for life after death. Now, the next section I may not read to you. It's about Rudolf Gatenbrink, who built a little robot and placed it in the southern side of the Queen's Chamber in the Great Pyramid and drove the shaft up at an upward angle. And the robot came to a stop in front of a small door with two copper fittings. The surprise of finding the door was complete because up to the point, Egyptologists had only spoken of an air shaft or a symbolic shaft. Despite the phenomenal discovery, at first the press did not hear anything about it. The discovery was kept secret, even by me. I knew about this because of my personal connection with Rudolf Gatenbrink, and I had promised him to keep it a secret. But how did our first meeting come about? So I think this little robot discovered one of these other chambers eventually in the Great Pyramid, which all of the traditional Egyptologists were, they never admitted it for years, but they finally had to when they started taking pictures of it, I guess. Yeah, Donnikin and this Gatenbrink met each other, I guess, maybe in a bar or something, or in a hotel, at a bar at a hotel. Let me read this quickly. In February 1993, I once again stayed in Saqqara and spent time visiting tombs and ruins. Afterward, I headed from the bar at Hotel Movenpick in Giza. I was tired, thirsty, and unshaven. The person sitting across from me looked at least as scruffy as I did. We stared at each other for some time until the stranger said in German, "Somehow you look like this Donnikin guy." "The original," I nodded in reply. "What brings you to Egypt?" I asked. "You're the last person I can confide in," the stranger said. And when he laughed in a friendly way, he seemed to be carrying a secret and thought I was an esoteric, one of the pyramid idiots to whom you should not confide any truths. In the end, I learned his name, which didn't mean anything to me at the time, but after an objective talk and some wine, we began to respect each other. Later on, he began calling me by my first name and said, "If you promise not to tell anyone what I'm doing here, especially not a journalist, I can confide in you." And so they've got, you know, they spent time talking and they went up to the hotel room and the one guy showed him this robot that he had built. And so this robot is pretty important and discovered some new stuff. I guess a new chamber that they didn't really know about. So that's kind of where I've left it. So, but you probably seen that sort of thing yourself. I wanted to dive back into the Talmud of Emmanuel. I know we've been jumping around a lot lately. Sometimes that's kind of fun. And there's an interesting chapter here called Entry into to Jerusalem. And maybe we'll look at a little bit of this and discuss it. And as they approached Jerusalem at Bethpage near the Mount of Olives, Emmanuel sent forth two of the disciples and said to them, "Go into the village that lies ahead, and forthwith you will find a female donkey tied to a post and a foal with her. Untie her and bring her to me, because she is a present to me and is only temporarily being kept there at the stable accommodation. And if anyone questions you, say, 'Emmanuel of Nazareth needs her,' and right away he will let you have her." The two disciples went there and did as Emmanuel told them. They brought the female donkey and the foal, and they laid their clothes on the old animal, and he mounted it. When his companions heard that Emmanuel, the King of Wisdom, was coming, they spread their clothes on the pathway. Others cut down branches from trees and scattered them on the pathway. In the commands, some who walked ahead of him, his companions, followed after him and shouted and said, "Hail to the descendant of David. Praise be to him who comes and proclaims anew the teaching of the prophets." And then Billy goes on to explain, as he does so many of things. "Hail to the descendant of David. Praise to him who comes and proclaims new teaching of the prophets. Concerning the very distant affiliation with the house of David, this has a special importance for the contemporaries and companions of Emmanuel. The family tree of Emmanuel and his father Joseph led back as is well known, to the distant past, to the house of David. But Joseph was not a potential crown prince in the succession of the house of David. And secondly, Emmanuel was openly referred to as a descendant of David only by some of his companions. The other companions who shouted and said, "Hail to the descendant of David," were only enthusiasts who knew Emmanuel's family tree. Nothing more lies behind it. There have been such enthusiasts at all times since time immemorial. They still exist even today, through whom historical falsifications have appeared over and over again and will continue to appear. And when they entered Jerusalem, the whole city became excited, and many asked, "Who is that? Who is it that is coming?" The disciples and the disciplesses replied, "It is Emmanuel, the prophet from Nazareth in Galilee, who brings anew the teaching of the prophets." The next section is called the purging of the temple. And this isn't a very interesting to hear the differences. I know you've read this, some of this before in the New Testament, but then to get what Billy is saying to us is the real story. It's usually much more down to earth, and it usually has a more profound meaning too when you start to study this stuff. And Emmanuel went into the temple in Jerusalem and became furious when he saw that the traders, vendors, dove merchants, and money changers had established themselves there and were doing business. Emmanuel was very upset and said to them, "It is written, the temple is to be a place of the teaching of spiritual knowledge and a place of the contemplation and the edification, uplifting of one's own thoughts and feelings. But you make it into a den of thieves." Now, it's very interesting that this, he says the temple is supposed to be a place of teaching, of spiritual knowledge, of edification, contemplating, but no emotional mentions of this was the temple for God or whatever, which I think is interesting. In his anger, he overturned the tables of the money changers and the chairs of the dove merchants, and he drove them all out with words of anger, not a whip. I think in the New Testament he has a whip. And a crowd of domestic servants, manservants, maidservants, and others who wanted to hear this teaching came to him in the temple, and he taught them all the teaching of the prophets. But when the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees and Sadducees saw the crowd of people who were listening to Emmanuel's teaching, when he taught and the people who shouted in the temple saying, "Hail to the descendant of David," they're still hung up on David. They become indignant in great anger. When they spoke to him, "Do you hear what's being said by these people?" Emmanuel said to them, "Are you afraid of the truth, since you get so agitated by it?" And he left them there and departed from the city of Bethany, where he stayed overnight. The next chapter, back in Jerusalem. I don't know if we'll, no, we won't cover all of this, but just a little bit. And when Emmanuel returned again to the temple and taught, the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and those of the high council rewarded, paid the elders of the people, came to him and asked, "By what rights are you teaching that, and who gave you the authority to do so?" Isn't that so interesting? It's the same thing today. The first thing that people ask are, "By what rights are you teaching that? Who gave you the authority to do that?" Instead of like listening to what they're saying and finding if there is any value to what they're saying, "Who gave you the authority?" It is so weird. Anyway, I'll continue. But Emmanuel answered to him, "I too want to ask you a question, if you can answer it for me. I will tell you by whose authority I am teaching. Whence came the initiation of Johannes? from your God or from human beings. They pondered, discussed this among themselves, saying, if we say it was given by our God, then he will reply, why then do you not trust in his teaching? And why do you not follow the laws given by him? But if we say it was given by human beings, then we must fear the people because they assume Johannes the Initiator to be a prophet. I guess we're talking about John the Baptist here, in case you didn't catch that. And so they answered Emmanuel, saying, we do not know. Thereupon he replied to them, you brood of snakes and adders, neither will I tell you by what authority I do my teaching. But what do you think? A man had two sons and went to the first one and said, my son, go and work today in the vineyard. He answered his father, yes, father, I will go. But he did not go. So he went to the other son and said, my son, go and work today in the vineyard. But he answered and said, I do not want to do it, and therefore I will not go. However, he felt remorse, and he went anyway. Now I ask you, which of the two did the will of the Father? They said, the latter. But Emmanuel spoke to them, truly I say to you, a publican or a prostitute would indeed sooner recognize the wisdom of knowledge than you would. For behold, the latter did not do according to the Father's will, rather he disdained him. So only afterwards did he consider the matter and go to the vineyard, which means that he did not do it according to his Father's will, but according to his own. Johannes the Initiator and the true prophets came to you and taught you the right way, and you did not trust them. But the publicans and the prostitutes did trust them. And although you have seen it, you nevertheless have not done penance and have not changed your minds so that you too would have trusted them from that time on. You know the truth, and yet you deny it in order to profit in gold, silver, and goods. Sounds like Washington, D.C. to me, and you enrich yourselves at the expense of the poor people, led into confusion. You lead them into falseness and exploit them in the name of the faith, and you are thought of God, and so will it also be in the distant time to come in the future. Because of the descendants of your bond, Guildcraft Association equals priests, pastors, preachers, sect leaders, and popes, and they do the same. But listen to another parable about a vineyard, that you might understand if your sageness, intellect, is not broken. There was a lord of a large property who planted a vineyard, built a fence around it, and dug a certain cellar therein. He built a tower and leased the vineyard to vine dressers and left the country. When the time for the fruit harvest and the payment of the lease arrived, he sent forth his servants to the wine dressers that they might collect the lease payment to them. The vine dressers seized the servants, beat one, tormented the other, and stoned the third one. Again, the Lord set out other servants. And unfortunately, we're out of time. I feel really bad. Hopefully we can pick back up tomorrow on this and find out about what happened in these vineyards. Anyway, I know the show's been a little different the past few days, but I hope you've enjoyed it. This is Ohio Exopolitics. My name is Mark Snyder. Have a great day. Bye-bye.